In the coming week, UN nuclear watchdogs visit the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in Ukraine. The UK names a new prime minister, and Chileans go to the polls to vote on a new constitution. It's September 1st in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's kick off our conversation by discussing the International Atomic Energy Agency's trip to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. The plant is currently in Russian-occupied territory, and it has recently experienced damage from shelling from the ongoing fighting in Ukraine. Many observers fear that a nuclear disaster could be the result. Where are we headed, Bob?
So we're in a very unusual situation, Jim, a very dangerous, unusual situation. I should note, as we're taping this podcast, the IAEA team has arrived at the plant, about 14 of them, according to the report I saw. They are due to be there at least through the first part of this weekend, so through the 3rd, maybe the 4th of September. And they are hoping to actually establish a permanent presence at the facility and as a way of making sure that the world is aware and that there is some sort of a neutral arbiter there to deal with the potential damage. Again, an unusual situation in that in an active war, and this plant, by the way, is right on the war front between Ukrainian and Russian forces, that there is a nuclear plant, and this is the largest in Europe. At least 3 of the reactors are taken offline, but it is still operating. Power is needed by Ukraine. There are indications Russia would like to have that power available to Russian-occupied parts, eastern Ukraine. There are also accusations from Ukrainian inside that Russia is weaponizing the plant and in some ways using it as leverage to keep Ukrainian forces away from that part of the battlefront. A lot of the shelling the Ukrainians say is coming from Russians. The worst case scenario here is a really bad one, which is that damage is such that, let's say, the cooling rods are not able to be cooled anymore. The cooling rods that power the plant that are typically cooled in a pool of water, that the water leaches away and the cooling rods are exposed to the air, and there is a cloud of radioactive smoke over not only Ukraine, but maybe part of Europe. This is a scenario that alarms a lot of people. The IAEA is going to be extremely closely watching that aspect. Russian officials have said up to this week that they would welcome an IAEA presence. We should also note Russia has resisted this presence, and China, which has been a partner of Russia's and spoken on its behalf throughout the Ukraine war, also leaned on Russia to allow this inspection. So such is the concern about what could happen at the plant that they would like to create a UN presence there. That doesn't solve everything, certainly, but at least would potentially cool off that as a conflict front. There has been reported shelling in and around the plant even this morning, Jim, as the inspectors were arriving.
What do we expect to learn from the inspectors when they complete their inspection, Bob?
I think one of the things we'll learn is the extent to which Russian forces have damaged the plant willfully, perhaps, because this is one of the charges from the Ukrainian side. And we should note, Ukrainian staff is operating the plant under Russian occupation. Again, very unusual situation. There was a little bit of that happened at the Chernobyl plant, although that's mostly offline. But after Russian forces evacuated Chernobyl, officials reported a huge amount of damage, and some of it seemed to be almost vandalism of that plant, which is very troubling. And so we might get a non-party to the combat coming in and saying Russia is at fault for X, Y, and Z. That could raise some interesting questions and some new pressure on Russia to stop behaving this way. Because again, this is new territory. It is an extremely dangerous place for Russia to be in. While Russia has been involved in some, let's say, nuclear saber rattling involving the conflict and threats towards, let's say, NATO, it has not done anything like this, where there's actually potential imminent threat of some sort of radiation leak. So I think we're looking to see how much the UN speaks up. It's the head of the IAEA is engaged in this. And I think there's going to be a great deal of attention about what the IAEA chief says, who's been a straight shooter through this process, and what it means in terms of dialing down the pressure on this plant. Maybe we embark on a process where nuclear plants, some sort of new set of norms are established for nuclear plants, because this is certainly something that is raising a lot of alarm.
Bob, why would Putin use a nuclear plant as a lever against Ukraine and NATO more broadly, when if there is a disaster at the plant, it could affect Russia?
Yeah, that is a really good question. It's been raised by a number of experts. It's maybe one of the reasons why you are seeing some Russian officials saying, yes, we would welcome the IAEA presence. But I think one of the thoughts is that the war is not going well. We've been in a stalemate on the Eastern Front between Russia and Ukraine. There are increasing reports of some sort of Ukrainian offensive against Russian forces near Kherson, an important city that is sort of on the way to Crimea, as well as on the way between Russian forces and move towards Odessa as well. And so if Russia is deciding to use some sort of brinksmanship involving this plant as a way of scaring off Ukrainian forces, you know, that is seen as a potential measure of maybe concern, alarm, desperation on the Russian side. That's just one scenario, Jim, that's been mentioned as why Russia would do this. We've seen Russian behavior in all sorts of ways on this Ukrainian invasion that has raised alarm and that has raised concern about international officials across the board, whether it's human rights or other officials who deal with the laws of war. There is very alarming and very concerning at this point what is possible on the Russian side, because they have mentioned Ukraine as not having the right to exist as a state, and that, you know, in the heat of war, there is concern that a lot can happen.
Bob, given that there is a chance that we could have a meltdown at this nuclear power plant along the lines of what we saw at Chernobyl or at Fukushima, do we know what would happen or what could happen in response?
Well, one thing, you know, is the health response. So I mentioned a kind of a cloud of radiation, which we saw to some extent come out of the Chernobyl accident from 86. And so you've seen a ramping up of the distribution of iodine. And there was just a report, I think, yesterday about iodine distribution from the EU to Ukraine ramping up big time. And iodine is seen as effective in dealing with mitigating exposure to thyroid problems related to radiation exposure. So that's one thing. It's just the sheer exposure to radiation from a very powerful plant. We're not seeing concerns about an explosion on the scale of what happened at Chernobyl, which was a certain different set of circumstances that led to something unprecedented there. This is more sort of an act of war creating some accident that leads to an escape and leads to, you know, sort of overwhelming safeguards. So there is a concern about radiation spread and the whole host of issues that are involved there. And again, we don't know how far such a thing could be effective. There are neighboring countries like Romania, Moldova. We've seen reports from Denmark purchasing iodine pills, for example. And so the alarm that happened after Chernobyl is starting to percolate again. And that also extends to things like agriculture and other things. So they're still learning, by the way, about what the impact on humans, on animals has been from Chernobyl, you know, 36 years ago or so.
But Bob, there's an obvious difference between this situation and what we saw in Chernobyl and Fukushima. Those happened during peacetime and required the mobilization of vast amounts of resources to be able to contain. Would Russia allow other countries to become involved in the containment of any accident or significant radioactive leak at this power plant in Ukraine?
That's another aspect of why this is so unusual, Jim. It was a big deal for the Russians to allow the IAEA into this plant, which is under Russian occupation. It was a months-long process. Brought this about because they've been there since the springtime. And there is concern that, let's say, Russian worry about the impact on the war front. And let's say, you know, Ukrainians, you know, ramp up an offensive on Kherson as this is happening. The Russians see this as a tipping point in the war. And maybe they block it, even though there's a greater damage that could include damage to Russian citizens as well. It's all kind of new territory, which is also one of the reasons why it's a really dangerous situation. I would also note for our listeners, there's a good piece on the CFR website known as Think Global Health titled Russian Roulette at the Zaporizhia Nuclear Power Plant that kind of walks through scenarios and walks through the areas of concern and what possible responses are available.
I mean, the fascinating thing about all of this, Bob, is that in the construction of nuclear reactors, a lot of thinking goes into protecting nuclear reactors from attacks by malevolent actors. They're designed to be crash proofs of a plane, whether intentionally or accidentally crashed into them. I don't think that people who thought about nuclear reactor construction thought about this scenario in which a government might consciously use its control of a reactor to threaten others. And again, this comes at a time when we talk about climate change. People are beginning to take a new look at the role that nuclear energy could play, because it could generate lots of electricity and not produce carbon. But again, if nuclear reactors become something that could be a target during wartime, I think that is going to stunt the move to rethink the virtues of nuclear energy.
It's a really good point, Jim. I would note that as this was playing out, we just had a recurring review conference of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it ended on a sour sour note because the final outcome document that they call, which they usually try to pass through consensus, was blocked by Russia because of a fairly neutral reference to Ukraine and concern about Zaporizhia. So this is showing that, you know, this crucial aspect of governance and the peaceful use of nuclear energy has been an area where there has been, you know, through thick and thin, more cooperation than not, let's say, over the decades. But this is now entering a new troubling phase where even just something in this area, they could not agree on some sort of a document about the safeguarding and the proper use of nuclear energy. So you raised a really good point.
Very troubling is, I think, a very good way to summarize it, Bob.
Well, Jim, I want to stay in the European continent on its Western periphery and go to the UK. Next week, the country will name a new prime minister. The announcement follows Boris Johnson's exit from the Conservative Party following a number of scandals. The candidates for prime minister have been narrowed down to Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. So, Jim, what can you tell us about these two candidates and the election?
Well, Bob, what we know is that Boris Johnson's time as prime minister of the United Kingdom is about to come to an end. Even though he stepped down from leadership of the Conservative Party earlier this summer, he has remained as prime minister. And the contest that's been taking place since Johnson announced his resignation has really been a contest over who is going to become the next leader of the Conservative Party. And given that Britain is a parliamentary democracy, the way it works is the leader of the majority party in the House of Commons then gets to name the prime minister. So this is about a Conservative Party, Tory party contest to pick a leader. The leader then replaces Boris Johnson. And it's been a fairly involved process to get to this point. There are, I believe, 357 Conservative MPs who have a right to vote. And the way this works is there's a sort of a series of rounds of voting, narrowing down the two candidates. That narrowing, winnowing process has taken place. And now we have the two finalists, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. And at this point, the choice goes out to all registered members of the Conservative Party. There's about 150,000-200,000 of them in all who are eligible to vote in this final round. Now, of course, a lot of commentators point out the fact that the people who get to choose the next leader of the Conservative Party are only 1% of the overall British population. So it's a relatively small slice of the United Kingdom that is having a say at this point. My understanding is that during the winnowing process, Rishi Sunak actually was more popular among his fellow lawmakers. But everything seems to indicate that Liz Truss is much more popular among the rank and file Conservative Party members. And they have been running a very tough fight over the last couple of weeks over who should succeed Johnson as leader of the party and hence prime minister. Truss is making a big deal about trying to cut taxes. That's one of her signature things. She's also running on a platform of patriotism. Sunak has, I guess, garnered some criticism because he comes from a very wealthy family. I believe their estimated net worth is well north of $5 billion, maybe north of $6 billion. There have been allegations that some of the arrangements he's undertaken to minimize his tax burden may be questionable. I know that Sunak has said that if Truss becomes prime minister, he will not serve in her government. And he had been Chancellor of the Exchequer, that is essentially the British version of the Secretary of the Treasury, from early 2020 until he resigned in protest over Johnson's activities and behavior this past July. But again, if the betting money holds up, Liz Truss, currently 47, a woman who modeled much of her career on England's first woman prime minister, Margaret Thatcher. I understand Liz Truss, when she was a young girl, played Margaret Thatcher in a school play, will become the next prime minister of Britain.
Jim, do we see any resonance of Brexit-related issues in this? Now, obviously, the Tories, through Johnson's tenure, were continue to support Brexit, but there are lingering aspects of that that seem to be troubling other Brits and maybe some of the rank-and-file Tory members as well. But are we seeing any of that kind of impact, or that's kind of a non-issue as this vote comes up?
It's a great question, Bob, and the answer is yes. But I should begin by noting that Liz Truss was a Remainer back in 2016. She was not a fan of leaving the European Union. Since the decision became finalized, she has switched scripts and she's a firm backer of Brexit. So we're not going to see, as best I can tell, that Liz Truss is going to reopen the question of the United Kingdom rejoining the European Union. She is going to continue on this course that Boris Johnson and other members of the Conservative Party charted for leaving the European Union. What she's going to have to deal with if she succeeds in becoming prime minister is the fallout of that decision, along with the impact of COVID. Right now, the British economy is in significantly dire straits. If you look at it, inflation is the highest among all G7 countries. It's topping 9%. Economic growth in the United Kingdom is at the bottom of all the G7 countries. Now, remember, Brexit was sold on the notion that the United Kingdom would be able to leave the European Union. It would break free of the shackles imposed by this overbearing bureaucracy in Brussels, and then it would go out and thrive in the global economy. That hasn't happened. And again, there have been problems with labor shortages, with critical workers who are EU citizens leaving Britain, going elsewhere, companies relocating back to the EU because the benefits of being in the EU are so great. There's been the problem that many British firms that want to stay in Britain and want to produce also want to sell to the European Union market because it is huge. But they've discovered that once you're on the outside, it's much more complicated. Goods don't move seamlessly. So Liz Truss may become the next prime minister, but her inbox, her economic inbox, is going to be full. And I should note, she's currently Britain's foreign secretary. She has been very forward-leaning in supporting Ukraine. I would imagine British policy in support of the government of President Zelensky will continue, but she's also going to have to deal with some of the fallout out from that war, particularly on the energy front. Energy prices have spiked in Britain, and that has had a big impact economically, and I think also on the morale of many Brits.
Jim, the reference to Ukraine war is interesting in that Boris Johnson came out early and strongly on the side of the Zelensky government on defending Ukraine. He's also been projecting kind of a global Britain persona. Is this type of thing that's going to continue? Do you see the UK maybe playing things a little bit more conservatively, pardon the expression, at least in the initial period of any new prime minister?
I suspect, based on what I have seen of what Liz Truss has said, that if she becomes prime minister, that she will continue this idea of a global Britain. She's in some sense going to double down on it. She's also offering up our tax cuts to stimulate innovation and economic growth in Great Britain. Of course, Rishi Sunak has countered that Britain essentially can't afford these tax increases because it has so many demands on its spending. But it appears that Liz Truss' call for lower taxes is playing well with the members of the Conservative Party who get to vote in this election. Again, we have to remember this is not all eligible voters in the United Kingdom going to the polls to elect a prime minister. This is some 200,000 dues-paying members of the Conservative Party deciding who their party leader is going to be.
Okay, so keep our eyes peeled on a new face coming out of 10 Downing Street.
Speaking of votes, Bob, on Sunday, Chileans are going to vote to approve or reject a new constitution. The document was intended to focus on topics like climate, social rights, and women's rights, and it was extremely popular when it was introduced. However, now many Chileans are worrying that the new constitution could actually undermine Chile's economic growth. What exactly are Chileans voting on, Bob?
Jim, they're voting on an extremely lengthy, detailed, some would say overly detailed, rundown of issues that comes from a new place that Chileans find themselves, which is a country that has veered towards the left from a rightist orientation, certainly from the Pinochet years and beyond. And for starters, we should note that this process, which was spurred by the massive protests that happened in late 2019, which themselves were triggered by concerns over inequities that had been festering for years on issues like healthcare and education, pensions, and so forth, that this was supposed to be an effort to correct that, to correct what we're seeing by a consensus of Chileans who voted for this process initially, that the Constitution was too oriented towards private sector prerogatives and They needed to get the federal government involved in correcting inequities. And so it's, again, things like housing, access to healthcare, and so forth. That then led to the creation of an assembly, which was a gender-balanced assembly that was going to take on the issues that were most important and put them up to the vote in this constitution. So what Chileans are now facing, though, is a document that critics are saying it's too far in sort of the progressive side. It's got all sorts of information in there that go too much towards giving state control over the levers of the economy. And that is why you're starting to see, according to some polls, showing that this actually might get rejected, that there are a critical mass of Chileans who are uneasy with some of the things that are brought up in the constitution, and that it will detract from economic growth, that at the end of the day, there'll be this, you know, deterrence towards business and sort of an upsetting of the balance. Because Chilean is a country in which there is a, let's say, a sizable group that occupies, let's say, the center left or the center right. There is certainly a right wing. There is a progressive wing. And some would say, but for whatever reason, this document that was produced is falling too heavily on the progressive side. There's also, we should note, as a lot of the supporters of the document are saying, that there's a bit of misinformation out there that's fomented on the right side of the spectrum about what the Constitution is calling for. For example, some are claiming that it's allowing abortion up to 9 months of pregnancy, whereas it's more of a broader swath of reproductive rights that then gets into those specific decisions at a future date and on a different level. So there's various issues that are at play here that are causing a lot of concern on both ends of the spectrum in Chile. And again, polls are showing this constitution might be doomed, and there might have to go back to, not to the drawing board, but maybe to tee up another constitutional rewrite. And that's what the current president, Gabriel Boric, has said, who himself has just taken over the country and had been a proponent of constitutional reform.
So, Bob, what happens if Chileans vote no? Does the current government just continue into office? Is a group charged with writing a new constitution? How long do they have to do it? How do you avoid sort of being in an endless loop of coming up with constitutions that people don't like?
It's kind of a crucial question, and it's going to be on a lot of lips if this turns the way the polls are showing, which is why the President Boric has mentioned he would try for a rewrite. The details of that I'm not sure about. There has been a very carefully mapped out process that led to this point. It was a 12-month period that involved a democratically elected group of people to this convention that drew up the Constitution, and they were representing a wide range. And you know, among other things we should mention, there was more representation for indigenous voices than has been seen in Chile before, for example. Certainly the government of Boric does not want to jeopardize that, but by the same token, doesn't want the country in disarray. I think the presidential election took place while this assembly that was creating the constitutional draft was playing out. So I think there would be some ongoing, you know, the country continued to function under the current constitution, which itself has been amended quite a bit. Chileans have been used to compromising on all sorts of things. So there's not an expectation of sort of fighting in the streets over this, but it will put to the test the new government about whether they can come up with some sort of practical approach and a timely approach to rewriting, to maybe coming up with a document that is seen as less alarming and that strikes that balance of both allowing business to prosper, but also increasing the voice of the central government in areas that people really care about. Again, healthcare, education, housing. These are all areas where there was a growing number of people feeling disenfranchised in Chile, and a country that is, to the outside world, sees as quite prosperous and as quite stable. And it is, if you look at some broader measures, but obviously what happened in 2019 showed that there were deep divisions and deep alarm of the direction the country was going. So they're going to have to come up with something that works. We'll see. Maybe this squeaks through, and that sets up a whole other set of issues.
It's always hard, Bob, to write a constitution. And the more details you write a constitution, I think the more objections people can have. But if you write a constitution that's fairly broad, you create a lot of leeway for future generations and future government.
That's a good way of putting it. And we should note, we recently discussed the Tunisia's constitution, which was a much different document that passed with, you know, a minority of the country voting for it that gave the president unprecedented powers. So this is quite a different exercise, but, you know, it is still a kind of a tenuous situation. But Jim, we've talked our way into the audience figure of the week part of the podcast, and this is where listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Jim, our audience selected 1,000 plus dead in Pakistan. Why did the audience pick that figure, Jim?
I suspect the audience selected that figure, Bob, because over the past month or so, Pakistan has been inundated by monsoon rain. Best numbers suggest that Pakistan has been experiencing 6 times the average level of rainfall this summer. That rain has led to immense flooding in the Indus Valley, particularly in the Sindh and Baluchistan provinces. It's estimated that 30 million people in Pakistan have been displaced or otherwise affected by the floods. To put that in perspective, that is the population of the state of Texas, or another way of putting it, something like 15% of Pakistan's population of more than 200 million people has been affected by the flooding. Obviously, whenever you have flooding, you have the knock-on consequences, particularly when it's large-scale flooding like this, because all of a sudden deliveries are disrupted. So you have issues of getting food and clean water to people. You then have issues related to disease, which can often spread. But if you can't get medical equipment, if you can't get water, can't get food to people, that can compound that problem. And this is happening in a country, Pakistan, that is politically and governmentally brittle and fragile. We've talked a lot on the podcast about the political divisions within Pakistan earlier this year. The sitting prime minister, Imran Khan, was ousted. He was succeeded by Shehbaz Sharif, who's had a very shaky start to his time as prime minister, in part because he inherited a divided country and an economy that is in tatters. Pakistan has been in negotiations with the IMF to get out of the debt hole it finds itself in. Imran Khan did not go quietly into the night. He has been charged with domestic terrorism for comments he made last month. So one has to wonder, what is the political impact of this humanitarian disaster in Pakistan? And I should note again, just to give you a sense of how big the floods have been, satellites are now showing that a lake has appeared in Pakistan that's more than 60 miles across. That is just an unfathomable amount of water.
Jim, you're right. And I have not seen that satellite image yet, but I have seen the episodic footage that's coming out about various places where, you know, whole neighborhoods are just falling into raging water. And it's, you know, you become a little bit jaded at all the climate reporting this year, and especially recently. But even with that, the images out of Pakistan are just stunning. And it does make you wonder how a country that's already been battered by a whole host of other issues is able to, how a government is able to withstand it. I will note that I think the IMF has come up with an emergency plan to provide some funding. But, you know, we talk about resiliency and adaptation a lot on this podcast and in other places at CFR. A country like Pakistan seems to be so far removed from having those capabilities in the near future.
Oh, they certainly do. And you're quite right that there has been a tentative deal struck between Pakistan and the IMF. And that's only the first part of the story. Now the government in Pakistan has to implement the conditions the IMF imposed. A number of those conditions are likely to prove to be very unpopular with Pakistanis, because it's going to, in essence, require them to take a haircut, to tighten their belt, to use the old phrase. And this is in a country of great inequity, inequality, great poverty. You have a government that seemingly doesn't have a handle on a lot of these problems. So you wonder, does it lead to a massive political shakeup? And of course, always got to keep in the back of your mind that Pakistan is a nuclear armed power.
Bordering a country that's also a nuclear power, that with which it has, say, not great, if outright hostile relations at times.
Let's say tense relations, Bob.
Tense relations is a good way of putting it. Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., visits Indonesia and Singapore. Indirect presidential elections take place in Lebanon, and the January 6th hearings in the U.S. House resume.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. We like the feedback. The articles mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Rafaela Seward, with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia engineered this episode. Thank you, Marcus. Special thanks go out to Esther Fang and Margaret Gatch. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying, so long.
And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye, and be careful out there.